to this week's Power Up. Thank you all so much for being here. Maude and I are so excited because we have a special guest episode this week for you. Maude, how's your week been?
Oh, really good. I just realized I have exactly the same bodysuit as you, so we could have twinsed it up. And I'm a little bit devastated that we weren't having bat books.
But wait, this dress?
Oh, it's a dress. I've got it in a swimsuit with a cape.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, no, anyway. I get it. But in this framing, we would have looked totally like twinsies.
That's it. That's right. Over part of a century. But we've got an amazing guest on Power Up this week. It's going to be so cool chatting what this person is playing, watching, reading. You know them from the guy who started an Animal Crossing talk show and got some of the coolest guests on the planet onto it, which is legit.
And before we bring him in, I have to introduce him by his opening Wikipedia paragraph because he's done so many things. I'm seeing him off camera right now rolling his eyes, which is my favorite thing ever. This person is an English screenwriter, author, game designer, and video game journalist who is editor-in-chief of both the UK and US editions of PC Gamer magazine and contributor to gaming magazine Ace. This person was the screenwriter of The Book of Eli, co-wrote After Earth with M. Night Shyamalan, and co-developed the story for Rogue One. Today's guest is none other than the one and only Gary Whitta. Oh, right there.
That's me. Hello. How are you both? Lovely to be here. I didn't know you were going to read my Wikipedia.
We just try to embarrass everyone.
I had to approve that ahead of time. My goodness.
You did not approve that ahead of time. But I feel like it gives a good rundown because, I correct me if I'm wrong, but some people meet you, Gary, and they're like, Gary the screenwriter. And some people are like, Gary the video game journalist. And some people are like, Gary the amazing animal talking host.
I'm a triple threat.
You are. You are a multi-hyphenate. I am
a multi-hyphenate. That's right.
Which version of that, though, is your favorite? Which version of all those titles?
I've often said I've been really, really lucky to be able to pursue not just one, but both of my hobbies that I had growing up professionally. I grew up loving video games and loving movies, and I would have been thrilled if either one of those had panned out into a professional career. And as luck would have it, because it really was largely down to luck, I got to do both. I had a whole career in video games as editor-in-chief of PC Gamer, as you said. And after that, I started a screenwriting career and have had some success there as well. But I'm still obviously, very well entrenched in the video game world. I still love games. I still play them all these years later. You mentioned, the Animal Crossing show and some of the Twitch streaming that I do. I still work and consult sometimes in the video gaming world on the development side. I co-host a couple of podcasts over on Kind of Funny. Yeah, I mean, you can take the boy out of the gaming industry, but you cannot take gaming out of the boy. That's for sure.
It's so true. And so Gary and I met in person for the first time at TwitchCon this year. We followed each other online for a while, but met, and Gary, correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of at TwitchCon, we're like, hey, another person who's not 13, let's hang out.
Oh, geez. Yeah. It's funny. That whole episode, the reason why we met, Trish, I don't know if I told you at the time, like last year, I was trying to make an effort. I'm a real homebody. I stay at home and I don't like going out. I don't really like people very much. I'm very much, I'm never happier than when I'm at home in my sweatpants, watching TV and being left alone, basically. but this part, last year, I said, I'm going to change it. I'm going to make a real effort to start saying yes to more things. And I get invited to go to various things and I usually turn them down. Because I'm a people pleaser, but then I don't want to actually do it. I think it was the comedian John Mulaney who said the closest thing that we'll ever experience to crack cocaine is the euphoria you feel when you cancel plans at the last minute. And it's so true. It's like, oh, I don't have to go to that thing because it was canceled. Oh, that's the best. But this year, last year, I was like, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to start saying yes to things. So I said yes to, I went to Silicon Valley Comic Con and enjoyed it. Went to Austin Film Festival, enjoyed it, and went to PAX West. And I always have a good time at PAX. And then TwitchCon, because I started kind of getting back into Twitch streaming in a serious way last year. And I'm good friends with some Twitch streamers that I wanted to hang out with. But that was the one that I really worried about having a good time at, because I fully expected everyone to be like, oh, whose dad are you? I just didn't feel like I was going to fit in there. But I actually ended up having the best time. And, my good friend Kate Stark, you met Kate there as well, right? You became friends with Kate, yeah. And we all kind of hung out together. And I was so surprised at what a fun time I ended up having at TwitchCon. I'm like, I can't wait to go to the next one next year, and I'm going to start saying yes to more things. And then 2020 happened. It's like, no, you ain't saying yes to nothing. because you're staying home. And so we were just bemoaning prior to going live. What a bug. I was so looking forward to like going back to PAX and going back to TwitchCon and doing it all again. But we don't get to do any of those things. We're all going to be stuck at home this year. It's such a bummer.
Well, next year.
The whole year now, a whole series of crack cocaine highs. The year got canceled.
Yeah, but like no, but there's no like at the last minute, like everything's just preemptively canceled before it even begins. And now and now we're all just stuck at home. And again, thank goodness for Twitch and social media and the internet for allowing us to all hang out together. I've said many times, I honestly think like thank God the internet infrastructure has held up during all this, because had it not, I honestly think we'd be looking at a Last of Us type situation right now. Like I don't know if we would have kept our sanity without the internet to keep us connected. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity to do things like this and hang out with my friends, you know, online, because it's really all we've got right now.
It absolutely is.
About your gaming past, it sounds like you've obviously, gaming's been a massive part of your life. What were the games that made you a gamer?
Oh, geez. I mean, for me, you have to go all the way back to the very beginning. Like I'm a member of the original generation that grew up playing video games. You know, my first console was an Atari 2600. And then growing up in the UK, the kind of the path that you take through gaming systems is a little bit different. Like in America, you know, when people say 8-bit, you think of the Nintendo Entertainment System and the Sega Master System. Mm-hmm. In the UK, if you say to someone who grew up in the 80s, you know, in the UK, what does 8-bit mean to you? They'll talk to you about the Sinclair ZX Spectrum and the Commodore 64, because it was more about the home computers than it was the consoles. There was a very vibrant gaming scene on both of those machines. And then again, as you go into the 16-bit era, again, in America, you think about the Super Nintendo and the Sega Genesis. We had those systems, but again, we mostly grew up on the 16-bit gaming, the Commodore Amiga and the Atari ST and things like that. And then it all kind of converged later, and now it's much more similar in terms of what we play in the UK as compared to the US and the rest of the world. But I grew up playing a lot of old Commodore 64 and ZX Spectrum games that were profoundly important to me. But like, I'm not trying to go all over, like, trying to be a game hipster. I'm into games you've probably never heard of. But like, honestly, these games were like so rarefied and so specific to the UK market that I doubt you've ever heard of Jet Set Willy or Manic Miner or Whizball or these kind of games, or Paradroid. But those are considered like big classics of the 80s UK 8-bit gaming scene. And those are the games that really made me want to get into this line of work.
Did you play Zork?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
That's like the one COM 64 game I really remember.
So for me, you know, I've always felt like I've been kind of a frustrated storyteller, and I always, you know, I love that video games now finally do tell really interesting stories. Like narratively, video games have come a long way. You know, it used to be Sorry Mario, the princess is in another castle is like as sophisticated as video game storytelling was. And so when I would play these old, very basic Commodore 64 and Spectrum games that didn't have much of a story, I would kind of like fill it out in my head and like kind of write my own fan fiction story for what the underlying mythology was in the storytelling. The reason why I love the Infocom games is because they were really the first games to really tell stories. You know, they're all text-based. You know, they marketed them not as text adventures, which is what that genre was typically called, but as interactive fiction, which is like just a loftier way of saying the same thing. But right. That's really what they were, because they were actually well written and they had beautiful prose and the puzzles were very elegant and funny and clever. And, you know, not just Zork, but, you know, A Mind Forever Voyaging and Suspended and Trinity and Leather Goddesses of Phobos and, you know, Douglas Adams, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And Infocom just made classic after classic after classic. And a lot of us who grew up from that generation still have very, very fond memories of the classic, you know, days of Infocom.
Yeah.
I was more of the MS-DOS generation. Same thing. Computer games were a lot bigger in Australia than I guess consoles were. The takeoff, I don't know, just took a little bit longer to get happening. But I was of like the NetHack generation.
And oh, sure.
That's what unleashed my love of RPGs. And it's like, you know, the graphics were atrocious. I played it on my Twitch channel, actually. And I'm like, I know this looks terrible, but this is probably one of the best games I've ever played in my life. Anyway.
Love. So much love for the old games. Yeah, I remember playing Zork. My dad got a hand-me-down Commodore 64 as I was begging for the Nintendo Entertainment System, because that's the kind of family that I lived in. I was the oldest, and my parents were like, video games, I don't know what that is. So yeah, someone at my dad's work was selling their old COM64 because they had upgraded to a Nintendo in their house. And my dad was like, yes, we will take that for my kid who keeps asking for video games. That's perfect. But I remember Zork, and then I remember the Return to Zork was a PC game that was one of the first to have actual actors in like short little videos that popped up, and the game was on CD-ROM, so it was like,
oh god,
crazy.
That CD-ROM generation that came to fruition in kind of the early 90s was really, looking back on it now, kind of a dark time.
Why do you say that?
Because there was nothing good that came out of that generation. Like the video, these little postage stamp size videos that were like low res and really shitty. I mean, do you really want to go back and play on the Philips CDI or the 3DO or any of the kind of the PC CD-ROM games that came out during that generation, or what we used to call interactive movies? By God, they were terrible. It's like, oh, we have this CD, we should use it. But yeah, the games were so bad. They're embarrassing to look at now.
I'm going to say that Myst was Blu-ray, not CD-ROM.
No, that was long before Blu-ray came along. I mean, maybe they did a Blu-ray version of it later, or like a remaster or something. But no, Myst was very much a product of the CD-ROM.
Well, genre. There's one.
Myst was the exception, but I'm talking about like the Sewer Shark, Night Trap kind of games, or like kind of like, you know, amateur video that was just really blocky and low res, and just, you know, and everyone kind of said this is the future, and these awful like CD-ROM encyclopedias, which were like 20 times more difficult to use than just picking up a book, you know, and looking up what you wanted. Oh my God, it was awful. And I get it, it was new technology and we wanted to try it and we were trying new things. But, you know, looking back on it now, historically, that was kind of a blind alley. Like we never, you know, it was like, okay, that didn't work. Let's try something else.
We see chat right now saying Night Trap, bad. But people sticking up for the missed video cutscenes, for sure. But I love this nostalgia trip. Maud has actually been streaming a lot of retro games on her brand new Twitch channel. Maud's only recently gotten into streaming. I know, Gary, your channel is about, what, one year since you said you've really been getting back to it, but it's blown up. It's huge.
I was playing PUBG. I mean, the Twitch channel's been around for a while. I was playing PUBG on it like 2-3 years ago, and it never really stuck. I wasn't good enough at PUBG to really, you know, continue streaming at it. And so left the channel to kind of lay fallow for a while, and then came back to it last year and tried to start finding interesting things to do with it. Never really like found an identity for the channel, like something I really wanted to, like, when you come to my channel, like, what can you expect to see? And it was like, well, whatever I feel like doing. And it didn't really have like much of an identity. It was like one thing on Monday and another thing on Thursday. And then Animal Crossing came out and I was like, okay, I really enjoy playing this. I play this every day. Why not stream it? And that was the beginning of the channel having an identity. I started a show that I did every morning called Animal Crossing Mornings, where like 9 a.m. every day of the week, 7 days a week, I just played a bit of Animal Crossing. And it was really popular and I really enjoyed doing it. It actually ended up being like something I look forward to doing every day, because it was a way to kind of start my day off on the right foot. Like Animal Crossing is kind of a happy distraction from the real world. And just playing that for an hour or so just kind of put me in a good mood to kind of face whatever shit the rest of the day was going to throw at me. And the audience started to really enjoy it as well. And that's how Animal Talking was born. I was goofing around in my basement, trying to figure out like how to decorate it one Saturday morning on Animal Crossing Mornings. And we started building the talk show set, and that's how it all started.
And how does one say, hey, I have an Animal Crossing talk show, Sting, you want to be on it?
Well, we didn't do that day one. It took a while to get there. What happened was the plan wasn't even to do a talk show. The original project was, you can go back and watch the original video, it's still archived somewhere, of me kind of goofing around with a desk and a couch in my basement, and you know, people in the Twitch chat kind of saying, oh, do this, do that, this will make it look more like a talk show. It really was like a Doll's House kind of project. Like, can we recreate a talk show set? Like, how much could we make it look like, you know, the real Tonight Show or whatever? And it ended up looking so good, and we got so close to it. People, oh my God, it really looks like a talk show set, that people in the chat started egging me on and saying, hey, you know, you should actually like try and do something with it. And so I called my friend Naomi Kyle, who's, you know, a popular, you know, actress and internet host down in LA, and said, hey, do you want to play dress up? Do you want to play talk show? Like, put on a dress, I'll put on a suit, and you'll come over to my island, and like, we'll pretend to do a talk show. And we just kind of goofed around, and it was really fun to do, because, you know, the talk show format is so, everyone knows it, right? Everyone knows the late night talk show concept. You know, Americans have grown up with it since the 1950s when Steve Allen was doing the Tonight Show. You know, it's at this point, it's so ingrained in our, you know, popular consciousness, you know, the desk, the couch, the host, the monologue, you know, comedy. Hey, I understand you have a book out. Let's show the clip of your new movie. Like, there's all these tropes that was really easy for us to fall into. Maybe we're just kind of pretending to do it. But it was so much fun to do, and the audience seemed to enjoy watching it so much that they said, let's do another one. Like, it was kind of infectious, and the audience wanted to see more. But it was never like, let's get big celebrity guests. Like, the guests on the second episode were literally like my wife and her friend. And it was just like hanging out with them. And then Kate came on the third episode, and it didn't really blow up until the fourth one, when Twitch started taking notice of the fact that we were doing something kind of cool with Animal Crossing, and they put us on their front page. And then we got like 17,000 people watching us, and it kind of blew up from there. And then like celebrities actually started to approach us, and we started booking bigger and bigger celebrity guests. And it just kind of grew like a snowball to the point that, yeah, in season two that we just recently finished, we had like Sting played live on the show. You know, Brie Larson came on the show. Selena Gomez recorded new music that she debuted on the show, and then sat for like the longest live interview she's ever done anywhere. It was kind of crazy, and I'm a little bit overwhelmed by the success of it, to be honest. This was never the intention. It was just to kind of goof around and have fun. It's a hobby that spiraled wildly out of control, and now I enjoyed it. Like, it's so much fun to be a talk show host. Like, just, and you get to meet and talk to interesting people, and it's always fun to see how much people are enjoying it. The whole original idea was, it just like, we're locked up during the pandemic, everyone's bored, what can we do, something that will put a smile on someone's face? And I feel like we've been successful at that, at least, and so for that reason I'm really, really proud of what we've made with that dumb little show.
Honestly, everyone, I feel like, found solace in Animal Crossing, because it was just so much, it was just better than what we were doing. Like, fishing was cathartic for me, you know, but I wasn't very good at the design stage of it all. But I want to ask you, now that it's been months later, because I've dipped out of Animal Crossing, are you still very meticulous and daily going in there and doing what you have to do to keep your island looking faster?
No, and in fact, my island has completely gone to pot, because I spend all my time in my basement, you know, where the talk show set is. I always cared more about having a nice house than about having a nice island. Like, my wife gets into all the terraforming and landscaping and all that kind of stuff, and she has a really nice island. My island's just kind of like, whatever. I just planted a bunch of flowers, and that's like a cheap way to make the island look good. I cared more about having a nice house. I was scouting for like nice furniture items and things like that. And then it became specifically about the basement and just hosting the talk show. I haven't actually checked in on like my island proper in a couple of weeks. I shudder to think what it looks like. It's probably overgrown with weeds and all my neighbors hate me. I'm a little bit afraid to check in, but I really should, you know, because it's autumn now, the seasons have changed, there's some new content for me to check in on. I still enjoy playing the game, but you know, I kind of screwed myself over by turning Animal Crossing, and you're right, Animal Crossing was already enjoying like a big cultural moment long before Animal Talking came along. We just kind of piggybacked on the back of that, because you're right, it was a game that came along at exactly the right time. Everyone's miserable, you know, the real world is kind of on fire and totally sucks right now, but hey, you can escape to this bucolic, tranquil tropical island paradise where everyone is your friend. And the worst thing that can ever happen to you is maybe you get stung by a wasp. I totally understand why people responded to that idea. It's like, oh shit, yeah, I'll get away to an island where, you know, I can leave all my troubles behind. And it's been a terrific distraction for so many people, I think, you know, to go to Animal Crossing and just play around there. And an Animal Talking is kind of an extension of that. It's like a fun thing to do, and people have really enjoyed it. And I think Nintendo created something really, really special, and obviously didn't see the circumstances into which the game would be launching coming. But boy, was it the right game at the right time. It was like just the breath of fresh air that everyone needed when we were feeling miserable about the state of the real world.
I was chopping trees as a hot dog. Like, hello.
I know, and I missed the whole boat because I was like, but I'm playing Final Fantasy VII. That was me. I was like, no time, man, no time. Someday I'll get into it, although my entire Twitch chat is telling me it's too late now. Hopefully it's not. But speaking of Twitch chat, We, Maude and I, could ask you questions forever, but we have special questions from the Geek Bomb Discord and Twitch chat. Go ahead and throw your questions for Gary in there right now, and we'll get some bombs away Q&A going on.
I've got one from Stormshanks, who I think this is actually a really cool question, but sorry to get into the writing side of things. Any quick tips on how to make the audience care about characters, or any overdone tropes that used to make people care but just don't seem to work anymore?
Oh geez, I don't think I'm a good teacher of screenwriting, because I'm kind of self-taught myself. I don't know what I'm doing half the time. I just kind of do what like feels naturally right to me. In terms of how do you care about characters, I mean, you know, it's, you know, I feel like you just want to make characters you know, as relatable as possible. I feel like the more, you know, people always want to create like these superheroic kind of bulletproof hero type characters, but the reality is, you know, characters that reflect real life and are relatable and have flaws are more interesting. And, you know, for me, heroism is not about being some bulletproof superhero. It's more about that kind of indomitable spirit. Like Indiana Jones is one of the greatest movie action heroes of all time. But if you go back and watch those movies, he pretty much spends all the time getting the shit kicked out of him. Like he loses and gets beat down over and over again. But what makes him a hero, he keeps getting back up, and he doesn't let the fact that he keeps losing stop him. And that to me is kind of the essence of kind of heroism in general. And it's why Indiana, I'm trying to think of a fight in the Indiana Jones movies that he wins. Like he just gets beat down almost every single time, but he keeps going because he has this kind of indomitable heroic spirit, and you know, and he has good morals and ethics. And the other thing I love about Indiana Jones, I'm trying to turn into like this whole like lecture on Indiana Jones, but the other thing I love about him is like he'll solve problems with his fists when he has to, but most of the reason why he succeeds in those movies is because he's better educated than everyone else. Like he actually took time to read books and learn shit about the world. That's why he knows the Nazis are digging in the wrong place, right? Because he speaks the language that they don't. And you know, it's the fact that he's a professor and bothered to go to school and learn things and read a bunch of books that ends up, you know, giving him the edge on the, it's not because he's bigger or stronger or tougher than the other guys. He's not, he's smarter than the other guys. And I think that's a more difficult thing to write, but when you succeed in that, you create a hero that I think is more sympathetic and more relatable.
Okay. I've got one here from Twitch chat from STS2884. Gary, do you want to be a professional talk show host now that you've done Animal Talking?
I'm a very unprofessional talk show host already, in the sense that I'm not very good at it, and no one's paying me anything. But I do really enjoy doing it. I said this to someone the other day. I apparently have wanted to be a talk show host all my life. I just didn't know it until I actually started doing it, you know, earlier this year, because I just enjoyed doing it so much. And I like, you know, I mentioned like I don't like people. For the most part, that's true. But I like interesting people. Mm. And you know, the talk show has become the greatest gift of the talk show is it's become this incredible nexus for me to meet and talk to, and in some cases become good friends with, just really interesting people that I would never have a chance to meet otherwise. And so being able to meet interesting people from all walks of life and pick their brains and talk to them has been something I'm genuinely interested in doing and continuing to do. And the nicest compliment that I've received from the show is that people have said, hey, you're actually good at being a talk show host. Like, you know, you're good at that particular job, which is really surprising to me because, again, I didn't have any training in it. I'm much more comfortable behind the camera as a writer than I am in front of one performing. I'll do my Twitch streams and stuff on camera, but that's just me being me. When I'm actually like trying to be like my talk show host persona, that's kind of more of a performative thing. And I have to kind of think about what it is that I'm trying to project. And I'm very flattered that people like that guy. You know, he's not me. He's much more handsome and hirsute than I am. But it's one of the reasons why I enjoy doing it. People say to me like, why does your talk show host have this amazing hair and you don't? You're bald. I'm like, well, I don't know, for the same reason your Warcraft barbarian is like rippling with muscles and you're not, because the whole point of playing a video game is to become someone else and to escape into another reality and pretend to live this other life. They're an escape from the real world, especially when the real world sucks as much as it does right now. That's the whole point, is to become someone else, to embody another character, and, you know, and to play make-believe, basically. And so I've been playing make-believe as this talk show host character for the last few months, and I really enjoy doing it.
I had an amazing character creation story like that, where obviously you make the best version of yourself. And I love the meticulous changes that you can make in a character creation. So I made the best version of me when I played Elder Scrolls Online. And it took me 7 levels to realize that I made a spitting, like, almost like a photograph version of Taylor Swift.
Oh, wow.
Like, if I show you it, it's insane. Anyway, great. Thanks for getting them in on the Geek Bomb Discord. Gary, thank you so much for letting us chat about you for that entire time. But we're actually going to run straight into the power part of the show and kick it off with playing. So hit us with it. What are you currently playing?
Ooh.
Who are we starting with?
You. It's all you. Today is all about you, Gary. Oh, what are you playing?
Okay. My favorite subject. Okay. I am currently playing an awful lot of Fall Guys, as anyone who follows me on social media knows right now. That has become the game that I'm mostly playing, both on stream and off. I firmly believe, and this is just my personal view, I firmly believe that that's the game of the year. It's my personal game of the year. It's the most fun I've had playing a video game in ages. And again, I don't want to harp on about it, but like that's what we all need right now, like just a fun escape. And Fall Guys is so much fun and so chaotic, and it will have you like raging and throwing your controller at the screen and cursing its name. But all the like in the it's like, fuck this game, but let me play just one more. You know, it's got that got that kind of magical chemistry to it. And so I just absolutely love it. And you know, we have this new show, Talk Guys, that my friend Kate Stark and I are doing, where we try to interview celebrities while playing Fall Guys with them. We've been having a lot of fun doing that. I just think it's an incredible game. I do think it's going to be a serious part of the game of the year conversation when that time rolls around in a few months. You know, there's obviously many other games that will be in that conversation: Animal Crossing, Last of Us Part Two, Ghost of Tsushima, probably Cyberpunk, and maybe a handful of others that I'm not even thinking about right now. But Fall Guys deserves to be up there too. People might dismiss it because it's this goofy looking game, but I keep coming back to this point I've been saying all along. Go on Twitch, watch people playing Fall Guys, and tell me the last time you saw that many people have that much fun playing a video game. Last of Us is great, Tsushima, all these games are amazing, but not every game needs to be a piece of high art. Not every game needs to be a devastating indictment of the human condition. Sometimes it's okay just to like laugh and have fun and squabble with other players. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant combination of kind of 90% skill, but there's always that, no matter how good you get at the game, there's always going to be that 10%, you know, random what the fuck factor that, you know, causes you to kind of throw your controller. And it's just full of so many delightful moments. And it's just an endless source of, you know, equal pleasure and frustration for me that I just absolutely adore Fall Guys. And like I said, my personal vote for Game of the Year this year.
Everyone in my Twitch community absolutely loved. So Gary and I and Kate all did a squad stream and played Fall Guys together.
Oh, we did. That's right.
That's right. And I haven't laughed that hard in so long.
This is what I'm saying.
So much fun. And my audience said the same thing. So yeah, I agree. I mean, it is not a game of high skill. Everybody can play it, although some people are better at it than others. But there is a lot of random like RNG aspects to that game that no matter how awesome you are, you might get eliminated in the very beginning, might make it all the way to the end and get a crown the very first time that you play. Apparently that beginner's luck is a thing. I still don't have any crowns. And tonight on your Talk Guys show, which will be just a very short amount of time.
A couple of hours from now, 7 p.m. Pacific. Yeah, we'll be doing that.
And you have friend of the channel, Felicia Day, and Amy as well on it.
Amy Okuda will be playing with us as well. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I would disagree with you slightly, Trisha, that skill isn't a high component of that game. I'll give you an example. When we played with Dr. Lupo, mm-hmm. on the first, who's obviously, he's an elite level player, right? One of the biggest Twitch streamers in the game. We ended up winning 10 out of 13 games that we played. I won 2 crowns. Dr. Lupo won 8. That's not an accident. Like, he's at least 4 times better at the game than I am.
True.
And so I would say, and this again is the magic chemistry of the game that's made it so successful. It's clearly a game that you can get better at. You can you can learn patterns. You can get better at it. You know, whatever innate kind of Twitch gaming skills you have will totally apply in that game. And you can get good at it, but like, and that's 90% of it. But no matter how good you get, you can never mitigate that last 10% random, what the fuck just happened kind of factor. Like crazy chaotic luck.
Getting yeeted right off the board.
It's design. We played, Kate and I played with the lead designer who told us that, yeah, we like deliberately designed the game to try and optimize as many crazy chaotic random moments as possible. And they found just the right chemistry for it. And that's what makes it magic. I don't know if you've seen like Shroud, now that he's back on Twitch, mm-hmm. has been playing it. Shroud is like the most composed elite level player anywhere. Like he's so buttoned down. I personally, no disrespect, I think Shroud's terrific, but I don't find him terribly interesting to watch because he's so composed. Like there's not a lot of, you know, he's not like a big personality, and that's just part of his energy. Like he's a composed, mm-hmm. serious, professional, like esports athlete, and that's his energy. But watch him play Fall Guys. He's fucking raging with everyone else. Like, if you can make Shroud rage, you've done something. And I think that's been really, really interesting to watch. And of course, you know, watching Tim the Tap Man like completely lose his shit as you know as he failed again and again and again to win a crown. It's a tremendously entertaining game, not just to play, but also to stream and also to watch because it's fun. It's just inherently baked into the human condition. It's fun to watch people fail and try again and then ultimately succeed and rage and tip their chair over and say, fuck this game, I'm never playing again, but then they come right back.
Yes.
Like there's just something inherently fun and crazy about that. My daughter loves the game and she loves watching these Fall Guys YouTube compilations where people kind of, you know, compile, you know, all the crazy moments that people send in. And Fall Guys is like nothing but crazy moments. I can't believe that happened type moments, like last second tail grabs and getting eliminated with a millisecond to go and all these, like, I can't, you know, just like, what the hell just happened type moments. Fall Guys was very, very specifically designed to like, for as many of those moments to happen as possible. Like, if you play for like an hour, I guarantee you at least like one, I can't believe that that just happened type moment will happen. And then you know all the trolling behavior and the griefing mm-hmm. and people like deliberately trying to like undermine other players. Again, that's all baked into the design recipe of the game. It's all very deliberate and it's just delightful. Like you'll never have so much fun being pissed off at a video game. Like that's the quote that you put on the box.
Right, Maude, have you played Fall Guys yet?
Sorry, say again.
I was asking Maude, have you played Fall Guys yet?
No, I know that Steve from Valley Folk wanted me to jump on and said he's playing it on PlayStation, but then you suggested that I get it on Steam, so I've been a sitting duck ever since then.
Well, you know, it just depends. I am a PC gamer, so I would rather play everything on PC myself. But, you know, to each their own. Honestly, I'll probably end up getting it on both eventually. So that you can squad stream with the most people. But when you are ready to play on PC, Maude...
I'm in now. Ridian also says, "Talk Guys is totally the laugh that everyone needs at that time. At this time, to be fair,
it's been a lot of fun. My co-host Kate compares it to Hot Ones. You know, it's like, can you eat blazing hot chicken wings and conduct an interview at the same time? Talk Guys is kind of the same concept. Can you conduct an interview while also subjecting yourself to this very just distracting ordeal of playing like one of the most frustrating games out there right now?" And it's been really fun. The first two episodes, I think, have been really successful. People have really enjoyed them. We enjoy doing them. And, you know, we've got some really interesting guests lined up for future episodes, too.
Yay. And just because we had it in our beautiful little graphic here, you also have been playing some golf on stream, haven't you, Gary?
I have. That's been a great distraction for me as well. I am a big fan of video game golf games, but not so much like the cartoony or arcadey one, like Hot Shots Golf and that kind of thing. I like the more simmy games. I go all the way back to Leaderboard on the Commodore 64 and then Lynx LS on the original Xbox I really, really liked. And then the Tiger Woods games through kind of like what I would consider like the golden age of the Tiger Woods games, like 04 through 07, I think probably would be the sweet spot for me. I played those games every year. I was really, really good at them. Probably the only game that I've ever been competitive, you know, in terms of online matchmaking. I was actually good at those games. Really, really enjoyed them. And then they kind of went away. You know, Tiger Woods' career kind of went off the rails. The license went away. And EA basically, the PGA games just were never really the same again. Now 2K has kind of stepped into the breach with this new golf game that very, very much scratches the Tiger Woods itch for me. And again, it's just nice to get out. It sounds weird, but if the same reason I think Flight Sim right now is kind of striking a chord. Like no one can get on a plane. No one can really go play golf right now because, you know, the real world is a dangerous place. So, but this is the next best thing, and being able to kind of hook up with some friends online and go play a round of golf in a gorgeous 4K rendered environment, high fidelity. It's just a lot of fun, and it's relaxing. And again, another fun game to stream. One of the things I noticed that when my friend and I streamed it, mm-hmm. we actually got a much bigger than average audience. Mm-hmm. I think that part of the reason for that is there's no onboarding required, right? If you're watching, if you tune into like an Overwatch stream mm-hmm. for the first time and you don't know Overwatch, you're going to be completely lost, right? You've got no idea what's going on. But you switch over to like someone playing PGA 2K. Golf. Everyone knows what that is. Like, it's a one-to-one, a recreation of an experience you already know. So you can instantly, oh, we missed that putt. Like, everyone knows what that means. So it's a very, very easy game for people to kind of engage in and follow right away. And I've enjoyed playing it tremendously. But I do get very angry and very frustrated. Like when I do miss that 3-foot putt by like half an inch, I am raging and effing and blinding at the screen, and people seem to enjoy watching me get frustrated.
Yes, my chat is saying you rage equally in golf as you do in Fall Guys on your
stress. My god, the worst. I'm kind of hoping they combine that at some point. They've got to do like Fall Guys golf. Like, if you think about it, right, Fall Guys is already like a mini golf course, right, with all the windmills and
yes.
crazy traps and stuff. Maybe there's a game mode they can add down the road where your little beans have to play golf or something. That would be hilarious.
Yeah, Nathan in chat says, I feel like golf games need to get weird. So Fall Guys golf would totally scratch that itch. Play in space or in Middle Earth or like a Cthulhu type Lovecraftian golf. Yeah, let's get weird with it. I'm down for that. But I also definitely see the appeal, like you're saying, Gary, of this beautiful, serene 4K golf course.
Yeah.
Just hang out in.
It's weird what our standards have fallen so low in this age of coronavirus, right? We just accept it now. It's been going on long enough that we accept that we just don't leave the house anymore, and we're probably not going to be leaving the house for a while yet until this gets sorted out. Probably sometime, hopefully in the early part of next year, but I don't think any earlier than that. And so now we take what we can get. And so a virtual flight in Flight Sim actually kind of feels like getting out of the house. When we had Colin Trevorrow, the film director, on Animal Talking, he wore a tux. He dressed up and wore a tuxedo for the show. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you're a little bit overdressed, Colin. So he's like, no, like, this is the first time I've had a chance to like dress up in ages. Like, he actually kind of felt like he was dressing up and going to a fancy occasion, even in the concept of a video game. And me and my friends playing golf, just kind of goofing around. For me, golf is the secondary, but that's really is just like the excuse to get together with your friends. Like, that's kind of the vehicle to hang out with your friends. The golf is kind of secondary. It's really just an excuse to spend a nice day out drinking beers and hanging out with your buddies. And even though we're not actually outside, when we're all connected online and chatting to each other in voice chat, mm-hmm. it's the same energy. I'm hanging out with my friends playing golf. I may not be outside, but again, it's as good as we're going to get, and I'm grateful for it.
100%.
Film freak Kevin just said people on Steam reviewing the game with just saying it's golf is the most accurate review I've seen.
you can get into a much more granular review of it, like how well do the swing mechanics work, how many courses, what's the user experience like, how finessed is the gameplay. And people that are seriously into golf games will take a deep dive into all of those issues. For someone like me who just casually wants to show up and swing a club, it scratches the itch that I want, which is all I want is a good online experience where I can hang out with my friends and play golf. And yeah, for me, that's the review. Like, does it feel like playing real golf? Does it scratch that itch? Yeah, good enough for me. And that's, I could write my review of that game on the back of a napkin.
Woot woot. All right, well, Gary, thank you for telling us about what you have been playing. Pretty soon we're going to move into everything you've been watching. But before we do that, we got a couple quick shout outs. I want to thank, thank you to all the new followers who are here today. We do have alerts turned off for power ups so that when this ports to podcast, it's not weird later. But I do want to say thank you to Classy Librarian and for the raid. Classy started us off with a raid. You're amazing. Critter Nation, thank you for the resub. Ridian gifted a sub to Shade EX. Thank you so much. That's so generous of you. Alienware 2020 gifted 2 subs. Thank you for being here, Alienware 2020. Good to see you. Welcome everybody. This is going great. We're going to kind of speed up and not do a Bombs Away Q&A after every segment this week because Gary has to get out of here to go do Talk Guys. So, you know, without wasting any more time, then, Maude, do you have any announcements you want to make, or should we bump right into watching?
Watching.
Let's do it. Okay, everybody, welcome back. Gary Whitta is here, and Gary, what you watching?
So, a couple of things. Just generally, I am terrible at catching up on the things that I should be watching. I work in Hollywood. I work in show business. I work in film and television. So it really is kind of part of my job to be up to date on like all the new stuff that's cool and that people are watching. I'm terrible about it though. I'm like, if you name like a popular show that people have been watching in the past, you know, couple of weeks or months, I probably haven't seen it. Because what happens is this, I have all these fancy plans and I say to my wife, like, hey, tonight, like after we put our kids to bed, like around 8 o'clock, let's watch that Blu-ray we've been meaning to watch. Let's watch that, you know, prestige movie that we've been meaning to, or, you know, HBO show that everyone's talking about. And by the time my kid actually goes to bed, we're so exhausted. We're just like, you know what, let's just watch something that doesn't require a lot of, you know, mental, you know, capacity or attention. And we end up just watching like crappy comfort TV. So, I didn't tell you this ahead of time because I didn't think about it, but I'll just throw it in now. I know you don't have a graphic for it, but it just occurred to me now.
Great.
Talking about like prestige HBO shows. The most recent thing that I don't know if you've seen it, but it's actually really, really good, is the new HBO Perry Mason show. Really good. I don't know if either of you have checked that out, but if you haven't, you should.
I saw the first episode of it, and apparently it's very, very different to the original format because this is a reimagining of Perry Mason. Like,
he's yes.
kind of like Hercule Poirot. But what it used to be on television decades ago, it's very, very different. It's a much different take.
So, I used to watch the old Raymond Burr show that was on in the 1950s. Yeah. This is set more in the night. It has more of kind of an L.A. noir, L.A. Confidential vibe because it's set in the actual period in which the original Perry Mason books were set in the 1930s. So it has that kind of classic kind of golden age of Hollywood L.A. Kind of vibe to it. And the first episode, I was like, I don't know, I don't know if it's really pulling me in. This is so different to the Perry Mason that I know. And my wife was like, no, I'll watch one more. And we ended up watching another. I was like, okay, this is kind of interesting. And by the time we got to episode 5, I was like, I am all in on this show. And we ended up watching the whole season and thought it was just absolutely terrific. So,
Do you think a season is allowed to have 5 episodes to find its feet now when there is such a saturation of content out there?
I mean, there is that thing. It's like, you know, I'll say, like, people say, oh, yeah, you've got to watch like 5 episodes for it to start getting good. And I'm like, really? Why can't it be good from episode 1? And, for every person like me who watched Perry Mason and said, okay, I'll try another one, there's someone who says, ah, that wasn't really for me. Like, a lot of shows do kind of have to hook you from the first episode. I'm lucky. I consider myself fortunate that my wife said, let's watch another one, because we ended up like really, really getting into it. But yeah, like I imagine a lot of people who may have had the same experience as me after the first episode, oh, it's not, this isn't for me. And they didn't have someone else say, no, let's watch another one. And they drifted away from it. But if you stick with it, yeah, it's really good. There's definitely a bigger conversation to be had about, you know, how quickly do you need to hook an audience? You know, when I, in the film business, they'll tell you got to hook an audience in the first 10 minutes. If you don't engage them in the first 10 minutes of the movie, you're already lost. And in television, it's like, oh, you've got 5 episodes, you know, 5 hours for people to start getting interested. That's a bigger creative conversation that's happening in Hollywood right now across film and television, especially in serialized TV. You know, it used to be the old days, television was like, here's one story and now another one and now another one. And it was much more, you know, a self-contained story. Now it's like one big story that gets told over the course of like a 10 episode serialized arc. And then, like I said, with Perry Mason, it's interesting because you don't think it's the show you're expecting it to be, you know, a show about, you know, this ace attorney. It's like, why is he a private detective now? That's not what Perry Mason is. But if you stick with it and keep watching, I don't want any spoilers here, but if you stick with it at least until episode 5, you're like, oh, I get what they're doing. This is actually really clever. And at that point, the show kind of clicks. But it takes 5 episodes. It's kind of a slow burn, and you've got to be willing to kind of persist with it. But if you are, it will definitely reward you for your patience. So that's my one that I didn't tell you about ahead of time because I literally just thought about it 2 minutes ago.
We have a recommendation show, so that when people do that work and put in the effort and go through to the 5 episodes and realize that coming out of it, it's the best show that I've ever done, this is where you share it so that you encourage other people to get into it. So we did our, you did your work, everyone wins.
I appreciate
thank you,
that. Yes, Trisha.
I said thank you, Gary.
Oh, you're welcome. So if you're looking for something that's like, you're like, what's a current show that I should be tuning into? I mean, there's all kinds of great stuff out there right now. Perry Mason's the one that because I used to love the old Raymond Burr show, and I'm a big fan of that kind of LA, you know, again, the LA Noir, LA Confidential kind of classic Hollywood vibe. I really enjoy that, and it does that brilliantly. It's a beautifully, beautifully photographed and designed show. Like, it really, it is like taking a time machine back to that particular era, and that's really amazing. But in terms of what I'm literally watching right now, I've kind of retreated. I have these periods of like retreating into like old comfort shows, like my all-time favorite shows that, like, if it's been a few years since I've watched them, I'll go back and rewatch them. Right now, my wife and I are going through a rewatch of Frasier, which is one of my all-time favorite shows, and we're just rewatching all of Frasier. Awesome. And just having the best, and just having the best time with it. I don't need to tell you what that show is. Of course, we all know. I just love that show to bits.
How many seasons is that?
10.
It is 10 seasons.
Yeah.
So what's that? That's 240 plus episodes?
Yeah, something like that. And we're working our way through them right now and just having the best time. And again, as a student of screenwriting, I watch them and I enjoy them as an audience member. But as a writer, I watch them and my jaw is just on the floor in admiration in terms of how intricately constructed. It's like, you know, some of the, you know, it's essentially, it's a farce. It's like, oh, quick, hide in the cupboard. This person's here. And if they see you here, they'll be in, this will be embarrassing for me. And it's all that kind of stuff that we've been seeing, you know, since the days of, you know, Neil Simon, and then later on, you know, Three's Company and all these shows that the whole plot's predicated on one simple misunderstanding, like a misoverheard sentence that leads to everyone kind of getting the wrong end of the stick. And it's just, you know, hilarious, you know, kind of slapstick, you know, piling on comedy. And there's one particular episode that if you've never seen it, I can't remember what season it's in, but go watch an episode of Frasier called The Ski Lodge. And it's rightly celebrated as one of the best episodes of any situation comedy of all time. And you'll enjoy it and you'll laugh. But when you think about like what it took to pull that off, it's the whole thing is like as a piece of storytelling structure, the whole thing functions just like a Swiss watch. Like, there's not a single element of it that's out of place, and it's just this beautifully constructed thing. And again, as a writer and as a student of that kind of craft, I look at it and I'm just like, I have so much admiration for how they did this. Like, it's so perfectly constructed. Like, that kind of stuff's not easy to do, and it's just so beautifully done. And all of the characters, of course, are hilarious and lovable in their own ways. And like I said, it's my happy place show. I just kind of retreat there and watch it and just marvel at how well made that show was.
Awesome. Maude, do you have a happy place show that you go back to from time to time?
Yeah, Buffy for me. But I only did the first sort of 4.5 seasons this run through. And I'm noticing Community is becoming that for me as well, because I actually laugh out loud in that show. And yay. Dan Harmon somehow managed to get a bit of a British Aussie humor, whereas I find a lot of like comedy shows in America, it's very American humor. And things that people absolutely love, like The Office, I don't crack. Like,
really?
I find it funny because it's a very distinct type of humor. Yeah.
Okay. And that shows such a great example, too, because you have the comparison directly.
Yeah, the English and the American version, yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like the American version is what you were kind of touching on. Gary. And that is the situational humor where it's like this the snowball effect. It's like this thing
right.
happened, and oh, it's getting worse, and oh, and it's that byproduct of like uncomfortable sort of like relating to that situation. I can't stand that.
Oh, it's, I mean, it's, you know, and a lot of people can't watch Curb Your Enthusiasm and that kind of, and the original UK, The Office, because like the US Office ended up doing a great job with it. The UK Office is like so much more harsh than that, and like so much built on the comedy of like, oh my God, this is just a cringingly awkward situation. I'm so fucking embarrassed for everyone in this room right now. The UK is like, because that's just baked into our culture, is like 10 times worse than the US version, like to the point where like my wife can't even watch the British version. And she has a hard time sometimes with Curb Your Enthusiasm because that comedy of the awkward is often so difficult. But yeah, it's interesting for a whole new generation of kids that now have grown up with shows like, you know, the single camera shows like, you know, Community and 30 Rock and Parks and Rec. And Modern Family and shows like that. Going back and watching these older shows like Frasier and Cheers, which are all still classic comedies and the shows that I grew up with, must feel very old-fashioned to the younger generation because just like a laugh track, you know, feels very antiquated now. But, you know, it worked for those shows at the time and still works now. And it's funny. I personally love that kind of farcical comedy that's predicated on, you know, all that kind of, you know, quick hide in the cupboard and that kind of stuff. I find that hilarious. But I also totally understand why it's not to everyone's taste.
Yeah, right. And I think that's really cool that there is something for everyone out there. It's interesting about the laugh track thing, because it's almost like these are the kind of shows that you get to unwind and switch off and not have to think. And the laugh track is literally like, laugh now. So it's like almost telling you how to respond to mm-hmm. their story. And I think that that's like, that was such a luxury then, where you're like, oh, you get to laugh with someone, and you're just told what to do almost when watching it. Whereas, yeah, in this day and age, that it's more like the fourth wall's broken, because they're using that shaky cam kind of mockumentary feel. And so it's just trying to connect person to person instead of having a track. Yeah.
I have a different view of that, perhaps because I'm of an older generation that grew up with these shows, and I never really thought anything of it. Like the laughter has been around for a while. And I also take issue with the idea, we're all calling it a laugh track or canned laughter, like it's, you know, it's just a recording. It's not. When you hear people live laugh on Frasier, that's a live studio audience, like organically, genuinely laughing to that moment. And so, if people are annoyed by that, I might ask why would you also be annoyed? Would you also be annoyed when you go to the movies and watch a comedy and people around you are laughing? It's the same organic laughter that the audience on the Frasier set is experiencing. I get when it's canned, when it's fake, that's one thing. But those are people genuine, that's a real studio audience. You say, cheers, it's filmed before a live studio audience. Because they want you to know that this isn't canned laughter. That's an audience genuinely laughing. And I don't think it is telling you when to laugh. I think people know when something is funny. And like, you know, I don't laugh just because the audience is laughing if I don't personally think it's funny. And sometimes I laugh at things that the audience doesn't laugh at. But it's just a sense of like, we love watching comedies at the theater because it's fun to laugh along with other people. It's nice to feel like we're all finding this funny together. And I think that's what the live studio audience used to, because they don't really do it so much anymore. Some network shows still do it, but it is kind of going out of fashion. But when, you know, the audience in Cheers or Friends or Frasier laughs, you know, it's part of a communal experience. Like, we're all finding this funny together. I don't think it's fake at all. But again, I understand that's not really a fashionable opinion anymore.
It's not, but you know, when people take the laugh track out of things and watches them and it feels so awkward, to me, yeah, as someone who, you know, grew up doing theater, I'm like, well, that's because the performers were holding for laughter.
Right.
If you take the laughter out, then of course their performance seems awkward because they were holding for laughter.
I agree. That's a totally bogus argument. I've seen those YouTube videos and I totally reject them. Like, oh, here's the Big Bang Theory. You can argue about whether or not the Big Bang Theory is a funny show, but like that's the show that I've seen this done with. Let's take the canned laughter out of, again, not canned laughter because it's a real audience. Let's take the laughter out of the Big Bang Theory and see how it works. And yeah, it's awful because again, the laughter is part of the element of the show, and the show is timed to go with it. Yeah, so let's see what happens when we take this critical element of the show out. Yeah, it doesn't work anymore, of course. You could flip it and say, okay, let's see what happens when we add laughter on top of Community or 30 Rock. That would be awful as well because the show wasn't designed to have it. Right. So I think that's kind of a sophistry type argument when people, you know, go, let's make the show something it was never intended to be. Oh, and what a revelation, it doesn't work anymore. Of course it doesn't.
Totally. And I just want to mention it real quick before we wrap out the watching segment, because you did tell us you were watching it, but I want to mention Eurovision.
Talk about Eurovision. I had my eye on this movie for a while. As a citizen of the United Kingdom, I grew up watching the Eurovision Song Contest. It's perhaps not something that is as well known to American audiences.
In recent years, it has been,
because you've been able to watch it now.
Gary, what? This is... Eurovision's a real competition?
But yeah. You didn't know that?
No!
Are you kidding me?
I didn't know that at all. I watched this movie and thought this was a hilarious movie and had no idea it was based in an actual competition.
It's been around since the 1970s, and like all of the people, I think maybe even longer than that, a lot of the people that are in that movie are real Eurovision stars, like of the real song contest. Are you serious? You're winding me up. You seriously didn't know that was a real thing?
Not many Americans do. Yeah, because it just doesn't exist here. But Australia got led into the Eurovision contest, between 5 or 10 years ago, and it caused like a lot of discourse over the globe because we're technically not in Europe, but we're here going...
Well, neither's Israel, but they've been in the Eurovision Song Contest for years. Like, that's another weird one. But in any case, I grew up watching the Eurovision Song Contest. I did, as did pretty much everyone in Europe. It's something that never really like... crossed over into the United States. So they do show it here, but it's like only on YouTube or something. Like, they've never made a serious effort to kind of get it into the American market. Some people do watch it here, but in like in a hipster ironic kind of way. I grew up watching it. I genuinely love it. And it's well known for being both this wonderful pageantry, but also just this exceptional train wreck at the same time. Like, a lot of the songs are really bad. And you know, the production numbers, like, it's like how ridiculous, you know, and clownish can we make this? And it's predicated on a lot of ridiculous gimmicks. And so it's kind of goofy, but also kind of wonderful at the same time. But it's kind of great that like someone from, this is what the movie captures really well, is the idea that like for just one moment, someone from like a small fishing town in Iceland has like the eyes of the whole world on them, because they get to get up on that stage and sing their song. And there's something kind of magical about that. And I think that's what the movie, I was skeptical about it. I'm not the biggest fan of Will Ferrell. I find him a little much sometimes, but he's been in a bunch of stuff that I do like. And I was like, I don't know, I kind of want to check it out. And we finally sat down and watched it, my wife and I ended up just having the best time with it. I thought it captured, I really worried that they were going to poke fun at Europe and Europeans and the song contest. Mm-hmm. And they kind of do, but they do it in like a really affectionate way that I think they actually made it like in concert with the Eurovision people, because they must've got a tremendous amount of cooperation to like use the official name, you know, Eurovision Song Contest. And again, a lot of the people who appeared in it were former winners and stars of the show and people that have actually hosted the real Eurovision Song Contest. And they just did a tremendous job of like capturing both the inherent goofiness of it, but also just like there's like a weird kind of magic to it as well. There's a reason why it's been so successful all across Europe and around the world for the last 50 or so years. Because it's ridiculous, but also wonderful at the same time. And the movie just captures that brilliantly. And it also has a couple of genuine, genuine, show-stoppingly good songs in it. The song that they sing at the end is called Husavik, is like literally one of the best songs you will hear all year. And they nail it. It's just so well done. The music is spectacular. It's just like a really, really, like for 90 minutes, just like turn your brain off and watch it. And I guarantee you, if you don't have like a big grin on your face at the end of that movie, I don't know what to tell you. I just had the best time with it.
I agree. I had the best time with it too. And I am still like, they're punking me, right? They're both, Maude and Gary are punking me. So I Googled it while you were talking. And you can watch Eurovision in the US for 2019 and 2020. They're going to come to Netflix. So I don't know if they're already on Netflix, but that's a thing. Now I want to watch every Eurovision ever.
I imagine that is part of the bigger deal that Eurovision people made with Netflix to make the Will Ferrell movie. The most fun way to watch it though, and it is still appointment viewing in the UK, even though the UK is spectacularly bad at it and hasn't won the Eurovision Song Contest since like the 1980s. We all love watching it, but it is a very like, this is going to be a train wreck, but like the most spectacular, delightful train wreck you can imagine. And again, just every now and again, some magic will happen. It's like, oh my God, like she's actually amazing. Like, where did she come from? Like this little singer from like some small town in Norway just like brought the house down, and it's amazing and it's incredible. And I love watching it. And the movie captures all of that. And it's also a great, like, especially now in the social media age, Eurovision has really come of age, because it's just so tweet worthy. Like if you want, when Eurovision is on, your Twitter feed will just explode with people like, I can't believe what I'm watching right now. Who is this person? Who is this insane person from Denmark dressed up like a dragon breathing fire? I've never seen anything like this in my life. It's just the theatricality of it is so over the top that you just cannot help but revel in it. It's just pure magic, and I love every minute of it.
I'm so mad I've missed this on Twitter all these years. How have I missed this?
You got to get in on it. Trisha, you saw the movie, right?
I saw the movie and I agree. The movie was like the injection of positivity that I needed. My husband and I both watched it together because I was like, I heard this is funny, and we're the same. We're kind of hit and miss on Will Ferrell's stuff. But I was like, I heard it's good. Let's just sit down and watch it. And we did. And we both really enjoyed it. It was the injection of positivity that we needed.
It's amazing to me that you didn't know it was a real thing. I kind of wish that you did, because I think you'd appreciate it all the more knowing that it was real. Ugh. And even the more spectacular numbers that they did, like, you know, people rolling around in giant hamster balls and people breathing fire and stuff, like, they didn't exaggerate any of that. That's what that song contest actually looks like. If anything, they scaled it down. The real song contest is, if anything, even more ridiculous than that.
So it makes American Idol look like a whiny baby.
Oh my God! Like not yeah. I mean, it's not even close on the same level. The Europeans can do this kind of stuff way better than Americans ever can. Like you want to go completely nuts. They're just so good at it, and it does. Again, I don't want to sound like too like you know romantic about it because it is inherently silly. But like it really does like for one evening, it really does kind of bring like the world together. All these European nations kind of come together and celebrate each other, and just like this is ridiculous, but we're all just having the best time. It's just so much fun, and I think the movie really really nailed that. Like it could have come off across as like a cynical American kind of, I look at these dumb Europeans. They actually think this is good music. They're actually looking kind of ridiculous. They could have gone that way with it, but they didn't. They actually really embraced like the inherent romance and pageantry and goofiness of it. Like it's all rolled up in one thing. And that's a very that's a difficult tone to set, but they got it absolutely right. And I just thought it was magical. I loved it.
I will confess I didn't watch it, but did you ever see Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly do Holmes and Watson?
No, I heard that was not good.
It was the worst movie I had seen in the last 10 years, and I had to cover it at a junket, and my interview just kind of went to shit because I could not disdain for this movie. I kind of had to retire my love for Will Ferrell because of it, and I won't watch, well, I haven't watched Eurovision for exactly that reason.
Well, like
that.
I would say watch it and he will be back in your good graces.
Yeah, sometimes you have to put a performer on timeout. That's okay. But maybe the timeout's over.
And even if you don't like Will Ferrell, watch it for Rachel McAdams, who is amazing in it.
Yeah, okay.
She is amazing.
Well, that's what you've been watching. I really appreciate your recommendations because you've actually kind of breathed the breath of life back into two things that I walked away from.
So I got to mention one other thing, and Trisha, who's seen it, will recognize this. There's a British actor by the name of Dan Stevens, who is brilliant, and he plays the Russian singer in it, a guy called Alexander Lemtov, and he chews this role. He like steals every scene that he's in. He is so over the top and so delightful and so cartoonish. Like he's the most over the top Russian you've ever seen in your life, but like in the most delightful way. And it's just every scene that he's in is just glorious. Like watch it for Dan Stevens alone. That guy needs his own movie.
I agree.
Was he slowing it down or was he Russian?
He sounds authentically Russian to me, but it's a very cartoonish kind of over the top portrayal because that's what Eurovision is. You know, everyone's like 50% more than they are in real life, but he's just wonderful in it. He's so much fun.
Bless you for answering that as a question, because that was just a blatant pun from me.
I see what you mean. Okay, I was a little bit slow on the uptake there.
Maud is the queen of puns, and I did look it up. Eurovision 2021 will be in May. So for all of you like me who are now marking their calendars so they don't miss it for how many decades in a row, that's when it is.
And we'll do a watch along, Trisha.
Oh my gosh, yes, please. Yes, it's like all I want to live for now. I'm so excited. all right, so Gary, thank you for giving us all of your watching recommendations. Let's talk about what you're reading.
I am reading, I'm currently in the middle, I've been reading it for like the last few months. I'm reading it like in bits and pieces because it's an anthology of short stories. My favorite science fiction author, and personally I think the best science fiction author alive today, is a guy by the name of Ted Chiang. And if you know Ted Chiang from anything, you know him from the movie Arrival. The movie Arrival was based on a short story that he wrote called The Story of Your Life. And that comes from an anthology of short stories that he published called Stories of Your Life. And it's kind of the title story from the book. And it's, you know, if you've seen Arrival, you know what a brilliant movie that is. That, you know, and that's all, you know, based on, you know, it's kind of a fleshed out version of the short story that Ted originally wrote. That story and all the others in that book are brilliant. I think even more brilliant is his newest book. It's called Exhalation, and it's his latest collection of science fiction short stories. I love short stories because I'm very impatient, and I like the idea of kind of like just bite-sized storytelling chunks where I feel like I've eaten a complete meal, but it only takes me like half an hour to read. I really, really enjoy that. And it's like, hey, you didn't like that story? Maybe you'll like the next one. It's kind of like a buffet variety pack of different story ideas. There's lots going on in a short story anthology. So I love short stories. I think Ted Chiang is by far the smartest and most intelligent and just best science fiction writer working today. Every single story is nothing less than than brilliant. And it's what I think of as it's proper science fiction. Like, it's stuff that really, really makes you think about the world today, socially, culturally, technologically. Like, every single one will come at a subject that you think you've heard talked about a million times before, like time travel, but he will find a way into it that's like, oh wow, I never thought about it that way before, and he will just blow you away. Ted Chiang, Exhalation, is probably the best book I've read in ages, and I haven't even finished it. I've still got a few short stories to go, but that's what I'm reading right now. As a lover of science fiction, I'm just, and that's the other thing. It's like, you know, as a writer, I talked earlier about how, like, when I watched, like, you know, the Frasier episode, I'm like, both thinking about it in terms of I'm just enjoying it, but also as a writer, I'm admiring, you know, the craft that went into it. Ted Chiang is one of those guys who's like, and this happens every now and again, like, you'll read something or watch something on television or a movie that from a professional point of view, from a writer's standpoint, I'll watch it and I'll read it, and I'm like, I feel really confused because that was so fucking good that it inspires me to do better. But at the same time, it just makes me want to quit because I know I'll never make anything that good. Like, that was so on another level that I'll never be that good. And so it's kind of frustrating and inspiring at the same time. All of Ted Chiang's stuff is like that. It's like, it's inspiring to read and it's elevating to read, and it will just blow you away and take your breath away. At the same time, it's just depressing. I'm like, I could write for 100 years and never write anything even approaching how good this guy is. That's how good I think Ted Chiang is.
Comparison is the thief of joy, Gary.
Yeah, it's true. That's a good quote. I'm going to steal that.
Yes, comparison is the thief of joy. Let it inspire you. You don't need to compare. Also, while you were singing its praises, I went to see if I could add it to my Audible wish list, and I can. So it is available as an audiobook as well.
Are you a big audiobook reader, Trisha?
I am, only because I sit in LA traffic all the time. And I know a lot of people like to listen to podcasts when they're in traffic. I use that as my reading time. I am one of those people, unfortunately, that read every night before I went to bed as a kid. So now I'm conditioned that if I open a book, I'll get maybe 2 pages before I fall asleep on the book, even if it's 10 o'clock in the morning. Doesn't matter. If I start trying to read, I will conk out. So I am an audiobook person. But yeah, that's what it looks like. If anybody,
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm going to off stream, either after this stream or later tomorrow, weekend, next week or whatever, I'm going to want to pick your brains about something.
Okay, great. Yeah, right. I'm totally down for it. But I am an audiobook person. A lot of the, when I was in studio, a lot of the shows that I host when I'm actually able to go to a studio and film are a sizable drive away from where my house is. So some of the recurring jobs that I have, I'm looking at a 2.5 hour drive each way in traffic. So that's,
when you look, I totally get the convenience of it, but answer me this.
Okay.
When you listen to a book as an audio book, do you feel like you've read it in the same way that you, if you had sat down and actually read it off the page? Do you feel like you've consumed it in the same way?
I do. I don't necessarily when it's a whole cast of people doing voices as much, because then I feel like a lot of the holes that I would fill in with my own imagination have been filled in for me, which I appreciate, but it's a little different. But right. A lot of times, whoever is the narrator for the book, I mean, as much as they try to vary their voice and pitch to be different characters, it's all kind of read as the same narrator voice. So it's still my imagination having to do the work of, like, what this character looks like, what I think they sound like, because, you know, if you're listening to Ready Player One, expertly narrated by Will Wheaton, not every character in that book sounds like Will Wheaton in my mind.
Right.
When they
right.
speak. So there is still a lot to fill in there, but similar yet different. I totally understand what you're saying about, you know, you have the narrator's performance as an added thing that in some respects takes away from where your imagination would fill in the gaps when you were traditionally reading. But for me, because I fall asleep so quickly when I read books, it takes me forever to get through books. I never minded that it took George R. R. Martin so long to come out with the next book because it took me that long to read them.
Right.
I'm very much anti-audiobook. I was a book lover, like the feeling of turning the page, like I liked to have it as a tangible thing. But then I realized I liked multitasking more. So I only ever listen to my audiobook when I'm walking my dog, when I'm even going to sleep at night, because it's like acts as, you know, a meditative kind of like instigator. But I am doing two things at once when I'm listening to my audiobook, driving and listening. So I feel like what I really struggle with now is when I'm sitting down and I open the book, I'm doing that. And it's like, put your phone down. And it's like, I have to get in the zone when I'm reading. It's not like an effortless thing for me anymore. But then when I get in that zone, after about 5 or so minutes, I'm like, oh, I should be doing, and I can't switch off in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never been a big audiobook reader, but I know many, many people, like for them, that is, you know, again, because everyone has busy lifestyles, and you said it's something you can do while you're doing something else, you know, which, you know, with a book you really can't, because it requires all your concentration. You can't really read a book while you're walking down the street. You're going to walk into somebody, but you can listen to a book, or obviously you can't read while you're driving in the car. You're going to get into an accident, but you can listen to it. And so I think, like, you know, given that for many people the choice is, hey, it's either I listen to it or I don't read it at all, because I just went, you know, who has the time? I think that's fine. But I feel like sometimes there's a bit of, I'm not necessarily one of these people. I feel like there are people out there that I imagine there probably are people that say, like, oh, did you read that book? Oh yeah, I got it on audiobook. And they're like, yeah, but okay, so you didn't really read it. Like, someone read it to you. Like there's some kind of weird snobbery distinction there, you know?
I think they're the same words, whether you're reading them or someone reads them to you, you know?
I mean, they're words going into your brain, right? Either through your eyes or your ears. Is there really a difference?
You're consuming. Yeah. Yeah. It's all consuming. But I will say that there are books that I really, really, really want to read. I'm trying to get through the Wheel of Time series. But the narrator is so mundane and it is wrecking the experience for me. And so that's like, I'm at the mercy of the narrator. But I've also had books that they've been narrated so well that if I read them, they'd probably be okay. But because an actor is not just reading words, but they are telling the story, and it has amplified the experience so much that I actually think that I'm a little bit, it's tarnished it, because I'm now holding every narrator to that standard, because that was so good.
One of the really weird things that I discovered as an author, because, you know, I've had some published prose works, is I never had trouble with, you know, listening to actors read my dialogue on screen. Like, you know, that's, I've had several movies made and heard lots of, you know, my dialogue read out by actors, and I'm okay with it. Doesn't bother me. But when my first novel was turned into an audiobook by Audible and they sent me the file, I got one sentence into it and I had to turn it off. It's like, for some reason, a professional voice actor reader reading my own prose back to me, I had like a really weird, like aggressive, like, I don't like this kind of, like, I've never listened to my own audiobooks. And I have two I have this book Abomination that came out in 2015 that Audible, you know, turned into an audiobook. And then I wrote part of the Star Wars, A Certain Point of View, 40th anniversary book that came out in 2017. And that also had a professional reader, you know, read my story. And in both cases, I got into the first line. I was like, I can't listen to this. Like, it really, I don't know what it, why I don't, I can't explain it, but it really weirded me out. I've never listened to my own stuff back.
Did it feel like a violation in a way?
No, I honestly can't explain it. It's something, there's something very personal about the written word. In, you know, because it's not, you know, when you read dialogue back, everything is meant to be said, right? Like, it's dialogue. And so hearing someone say it doesn't feel unnatural to me. When I wrote my first novel, I didn't really think about audio, but I subsequently learned that audiobooks are like 50% of the market and you have to cater to that market. But when I was writing, I just thought about, I'm gonna write this and someone's gonna read it. It's gonna go into their brain through their eyes. And none of this is ever going to be spoken aloud. And I just found it really, really weird. I never thought about the audiobook thing, but when it was inevitably turned into an audiobook, because that's a box you have to check when you publish something, you can't not do an audio version if you want it to be a legitimate book. I just assume, and other people have told me that they enjoyed listening to the Abomination audiobook and the Star Wars book that I did, but I just have to take their word for it because I can't listen to it. I cannot explain it. It just feels weird to me.
I always enjoy when authors narrate their own books. Like Felicia Day did right. Both of her audiobooks. But one's kind of more instructional in tone and the other's autobiographical in tone. So it makes a little bit more sense than just kind of like a fictional prose type. But yeah, I always enjoy that. The other one that was so funny because, you know, Maude talks about how a bad narrator can like ruin everything. I put a trash book on my Audible and the narrator was not good, but she wrote the book And it was great. I had a great experience.
When you say a trash book, what do you mean? Like a trashy airport kind of book that you pick up?
Yes. Like when you put on just a trashy TV show that you know is going to be trash. So I'll tell you what it was. What is the name of it? It's Holly Madison's book.
Did she narrate it?
She narrates it. And she's not a great voice performer, but I so enjoyed hearing her. Oh, it's called Down the Rabbit Hole. I so enjoyed hearing her read it because it's her story.
Yeah.
That even though her kind of pacing was awkward and, you know, it still totally worked. Yeah, that was just a I'm downloading a bunch of books to get through my traffic this week. And that was one that I buzzed through super quick but it was great.
Why would you want to do that yourself? Like, let someone who does that for a living do it, you know?
I guess because it's her story. I don't know. But honestly, I was like, hats off to you, girl.
I can understand Felicia narrating her own autobiography. Like, you kind of want to hear that in her own words. That makes total sense. But prose fiction, let a professional do the job.
Yeah, I think if it's written in the first person about that person, have the person read it. Yeah, that makes sense. Would you do that? Would you narrate your own book if you did another one?
No. I mean, again, if it was nonfiction, if it was in my own voice, if it was, say, not that I ever would because my life's not that interesting, but if I did an autobiography, it would be weird for someone else to read that, right? Because it would all be in the first person. You would want to hear that in my own voice. Or if you're writing a history or something, a nonfiction, I think it's perfectly valid for the author to read their own work. But in a, I wouldn't presume to read my own audio novel any more than I would have presumed to play, Eli in the Book of Eli. Like, trust me, Denzel Washington's going to do a better job than me. And so why wouldn't, it's a narrative, it's a dramatic performance, right? Even when you're reading a book, there's acting, you're reading the dialogue of the characters, you're creating a mood, you're setting a scene. You want a professional actor to do that for you. Like, I can write it, but I can't perform it. I need a performer to do that part.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Gary, thank you so much for telling us all about Exhalation and about what you've been reading. And just thank you for being here for this week's Power Up. You have been such a joy. You're always such a joy to chat with, but tonight has been extra lovely. And now we get to share it with the community, all of your wonderful recommendations. So before we let you go, because again, I know you have talk guys in just a bit. Before we let you go, can you tell people where to find you and all the shows they can watch on your Twitch channel?
Yeah, so on my main social outlet these days is Twitter. You can find me at Gary Whitta, GARYWHITTA. That's where I kind of, promote all my other stuff as well and complain about Trump and, video games and stuff like that. The one thing I'm really trying to do right now is grow the YouTube channel. That's where Animal Talking lives, all the full episodes of Animal Talking there, along with clips and highlights. Our new show, Talk Guys, is also archived there, and a bunch of other fun stuff too. That's at youtube.com/gwitta, GWHITTA. Please do go toss us a sub. Don't forget to like and subscribe and all that stuff that we're supposed
ring
to say.
Bell.
Ring that bell, smash that bell. I'm learning how to do all this stuff. We are really trying to grow the YouTube channel, and there's some genuinely interesting stuff coming to that YouTube channel very soon that I can't talk about just yet, but really excited about the future of that channel. Instagram, GWitta. And then Twitch, twitch.tv/GaryWhitta. Again, if you want to come check us out tonight, 7 o'clock Pacific, twitch.tv/GaryWhitta. And again, it's also broadcast on my friend Kate's channel, twitch.tv/Kate. We both broadcast Talk Guys together. We're playing tonight with Felicia Day and Amy Okuda. And that's where you can find me.
Awesome. Fantastic. Gary, it's always such a joy to talk to you. Go ahead, Matt.
I love it. Listen, Trisha, I got to say, I'm always excited to make, I'm very picky about the company I keep, and I don't make new friends easily. So I got to say, it was a genuine delight to meet you at TwitchCon last year and make a new friend. I'm really, really glad that you and I become friends. I hope we get to do lots of stuff in the future together. And Maud, I just met you for the first time today, but you're delightful as well. I'm glad to have met you also. I'm glad we did this.
Oh, that's so sweet. I wasn't ready for that.
Getting chance is a very special episode.
Aww. It's the unexpected sweetness of Gary Whitta that will get you.
I know. I'm telling you, you don't see it coming because I'm so grumpy and curmudgeonly and kind of prickly on the outside. But there's a soft center underneath. You just gotta work to get there.
Well, we really appreciate you dedicating your afternoon to telling us what you have been playing and watching and reading. And honestly, I am so pumped to read that book. It is 100% my jam, and I'm also a little bit embarrassed that I haven't already heard of it or consumed it. But we got an audiobook now, aren't we, Trisha?
Ooh. Oh yeah, it's already on my audiobook wish list, and I've already marked my calendar for Eurovision 2021.
Oh, we're doing it. We're going to simulcast.
Yes, please. I love it.
All right, we're doing it.
Gary, we love you. Bye, everybody. Thank you so much for watching, and we'll see you soon.
Bye. Thank you.
Watch Talk Guys tonight.
Tonight, 7 o'clock.